Well, our guest tonight is Dr. Jeffrey Long as we talk about near-death experiences. Next hour, Kim Sharp joins us. She came into a near-death experience. Then later on, we'll open up your phone lines and give you an opportunity to relate to your near-death experiences, NDEs. Tonight, I was grabbing a quick bite to eat in Los Angeles. You've got valet parkers and people all over the place. Well, a friend of mine heads up, you know, the entire valet area of a place. And he said, "What's on the show tonight, George?" And I said, "Well, we're going to talk about near-death experiences." He says, "You got a minute? I've got to tell you this." He was telling me the story. He said, I'll tell you, I came so close to actually dying, it wasn't funny. And he told me about when he was in Nebraska, right near the Iowa border there. He was on a frozen lake, and his brother apparently was on one of these all-terrain vehicles driving around the lake, and this thing was so thick, people would take their trucks out there. And Randy went on to tell me, he says, "I think my brother must have cracked some of the ice, because I went running after him because it was my turn next to be on the all-terrain vehicle. So as I was running, I went right through the ice, right down." And he said, just like the movie in The Omen, where the kid was floating on the, you know, underneath the ice, "I couldn't find the opening, George, where I fell through." And he said, "I was starting to float away." And he said, "It was horrible." He said, "I knew I was dying, and I was wearing this heavy winter coat, heavy rubber boots, and everything was weighing me down. The wetter he got, he was always soaked. He was in the lake underneath the ice." He said, "It was pulling him down even more." And he said, "Every time he would be able to get enough strength to pull himself up to the top, he broke more of the ice, so he kept sinking down further and further." He said, "George, I was a goner. And as I went up one more time, I took a gulp of air," and he must have been about 11 years old. He said, "I screamed, and there was a guy doing some ice fishing about 200 feet away, and he heard me. And he came running over there, and he had with him a boat oar, and he held it out to me. I popped up one more time. I grabbed the oar, and he pulled me to safety. They then took me to a cabin where they just put blankets on me, took off that clothes, and kept me by a fireplace until the shivering had stopped, which took me 2 hours. I was shaking so hard." He said, "That's as close to death as I've ever had it." And he said, "I'll be listening tonight." So in a moment, Dr. Jeffrey Long on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jeffrey Long is a leading near-death experience researcher, NDE. He founded the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. All his websites, by the way, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, because he's got a whole bunch of them. Two other websites devoted to experiences related to NDEs: After Death Communication Research Foundation and Out of Body Experience Research Foundation. Dr. Long also serves on the Physician Advisory Committee of the International Association for Near Death Studies and chairs its research committee. The family of websites, the largest publicly accessible collection of exceptional human experiences of their type available. This is leading to increasing awareness that worldwide and across cultural boundaries, we all share these type of experiences, and they are very similar to a degree that is medically inexplainable. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Dr. Jeffrey Long. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome back. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great, George. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
I don't know if you heard that story right before you came on about my friend here when he was a little kid.
Boy, I did.
Breaking through the ice. What a horrible feeling. Would you consider that to be, because what is the definition, Jeffrey, of near death? I mean, is near death you have died, or you came back? Or in this case, he came very close to death. I would say that was near death.
Yeah, that was a chilling story he gave. I grew up in Iowa, and I know how cold that water is in the wintertime. That experience he had, it would be near death. In other words, he clearly nearly died breaking through ice and going into that freezing lake. But what makes near-death experience different from that is that you lose consciousness or even are declared clinically dead, and yet you have an experience that in which you are at a high degree of consciousness, you're very aware and alert, and you have an experience with a very ordered pattern of experience elements generally. Experience elements that seem to be constant, whether you're a child, whether you're in the United States or anywhere and far removed, even in non-Western civilizations. That's when it becomes a near-death experience, or a NDE.
I want to ask you a question that I've wanted to get an answer for. I've never been able to. I don't even know, Jeffrey, if you might be able to answer it, but you more than anybody might get pretty close to it. Somebody goes to sleep, and they die in their sleep. Let's assume there is an afterlife here. What do you think transpires? What do you think they know? What happens to them in that kind of scenario?
I think near-death experiences give an answer to that, because there are people that have some kind of a life-threatening event. Often it's a cardiac. They'll have a heart attack while they're asleep, and they have a near-death experience, and then they awake, or they come back around, but it actually occurred while they were asleep. So I think I have some idea. It's probably what other near-death experiencers have described, and that's a large population. About 4% of the United States adults have had a near-death experience, so they probably go through that type of experience elements when they die, even while they're in their sleep. Probably the same experience that happens when they're not in their sleep, George.
Do you think they fall into some kind of dream state where they may stay there, you know, maybe until the end of time, and they just keep dreaming of different things?
Oh, absolutely not. If there's one thing that's clear, near-death experiences have nothing at all to do with dreams.
Okay.
In fact, we used to ask that as a question in our web survey that we did of near-death experiencers. We asked, are the NDEs dreamlike in any way, which is a loaded question which would tend to elicit an affirmative or a yes response if there was any similarity whatsoever. And to summarize what hundreds of near-death experiencers shared with us, the answer to that question, is an NDE dreamlike in any way, is not just no, but absolutely no. So I don't really think it's anything like dreams. It's not like dreaming and not waking up. You go on to a near-death experience. Now, the good news is, unlike a dream, near-death experiences, at least the great majority of them, are actually fantastic, wonderful experiences, so much, much better than an eternal dream.
Why would they be wonderful?
Well, we don't really know. We just don't know from observation, and in my research, we've had about 800 near-death experiencers share with me over the years. So what I've noticed is that, as what other near-death experience researchers have noticed, is a very startling consistency in these experiences. So, you know, I don't know why they're wonderful, but they are. They have the typical NDE element. There's an out-of-body experience often initially. They may pass through a tunnel. They may see a light at the end of the tunnel. Very often they encounter deceased relatives, essentially never relatives or any other people that are alive at the time of their experience. They may have a life review, and then often there's a decision about whether to return to Earth or not. So out of all those typical elements, it doesn't really capture the emotions of or the intensity of the experience. When people have these experiences, they, especially on the other side, feel intense love. Their initial reaction, and very profoundly felt reaction generally, is that when they're on the other side, this is home, not Earth, not where we live today, but home, the real home, is on the other side. And that's wonderful.
You belong to a number of near-death experience research organizations and foundations. I mean, a number of them. What's new with them? I mean, are they doing any work, any research?
Well, I think a lot of what we're doing is looking over the most recent NDE article that was published by Dr. Nelson in one of the leading journals, Neurology, just within the last several weeks. This study purported to find a physiological correlate of near-death experience. And that the actual article that was written talked about it, near-death experiences being caused by REM, R-E-M, which is an abbreviation for rapid eye movement intrusion. And that just is, there's a variety of clinical situations where that can be seen. But really the bottom line is, I think as us in the research community have looked that over and other people that are interested in it, it just reinforces our opinion that there's really no medical explanation for near-death experience at all. The study, there's certainly some serious methodology issues. In other words, it could have been done better to be more conclusive. And even more importantly, as we've said all along, there's just some elements of near-death experience that absolutely defy any medical description or explanation whatsoever.
Yeah, tell me, Dr. Long, how did they conduct the study?
Now, what they did, actually, I got involved in this early by helping the authors of this study recruit near-death experiencers, because we have such an enormous database of near-death experiencers. For those that gave us advance permission to contact them periodically, we did, and asked them if they wanted to be in the study. This was a very ethically and appropriately conducted medical study. And the major part of this study was to interview 55 people that had a near-death experience and 55 people that were a so-called control group. In other words, they were the same age and gender, male or female, if you will, as the NDE group, and asked them a series of questions about whether they'd had any prior life experience of this so-called REM intrusion. And that would be things like sleep paralysis, which is like waking up and not being able to move, right, or having some visual or hallucinations of hearing things which other people can't hear, either right before you fall asleep or right before you wake up. They're really not rare, George. A significant percentage of the population has these types of things during their life, and they're certainly not by themselves indicating that there's a major medical problem. But the finding of this study was that the NDE group seemed to have a much higher likelihood of answering these questions affirmatively than the control group. So the study said this raised the possibility that these NDE people had a predisposition for this REM intrusion, and maybe that's what caused the NDE. Just, again, speculative conjecture, really not absolutely proving, definitely that there's a correlation between REM intrusion and NDE, and certainly far, far from proving that this REM intrusion phenomena causes NDE.
Does that also create doubt in terms of whether there is an afterlife, this particular study, one way or another?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, and even though the authors of that study were very cautious about the fact that these findings are preliminary and that further study is absolutely necessary to really nail this down, a lot of the media portrayals suggested that this proved that this is why NDE happened, that it had a physiological cause. I am aware of a number of people that have had some concerns that this may suggest that what we all thought was one of the strongest pieces of evidence that there is an afterlife and that that afterlife is wonderful might not be true. But you know, again, the more you read the story and look at the study, I should say, and look it over, the more you become convinced that, you know, it really doesn't put much of a dent in the in the near-death experience phenomena or how we've all understood it or how we've all portrayed it on many prior coast-to-coast AM shows. I mean, that's really the real thing.
The people who experience NDEs, do they come back with any special psychic gifts, Jeffrey?
They certainly can, and that's been a real interesting topic. I actually did a study of that and did a survey of over 100 near-death experiencers and tried to get that nailed down. A whole variety of psychic phenomena have been brought up. Some come back commonly with intuitive psychic abilities. They seem to understand other people's thoughts, especially shortly after the NDE. They seem to understand either people's thoughts or their moods in a way that is inexplicable.
And they didn't have it before the experience, right?
No, this for them, it's very clearly a change.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very surprised by this, and sometimes it results in some real adjustment reactions, and sometimes they aren't even happy they have this gift. There can also be some NDEers that come back believing that they can have some healing abilities, and some have gone on to even be professional healers. Others have come back and seem to have some ability potentially to foretell future events, and that's been a very interesting category of NDEs. So that was some of the major types of psychic ability that NDEers believe they come back with.
Does the person who experiences the NDE, is it vary? I mean, male, female, young, old? Ethnicity, does it matter?
Absolutely not. This can happen we've had near-death experiences from people that aren't yet 2 years old, and we've had near-death experiences people in their 80s. It can occur in children, adults. The first near-death experience was recorded at the time of Plato thousands of years ago, and NDEs can occur all across the world, both in America and non-Western civilizations. They can occur in atheists, they can occur in agnostics, and they can occur in individuals of all religious faith.
I wonder if an atheist comes back as a believer after an NDE.
That's a great question. The answer to that is we have had quite a few people that indicated they were atheists at the time they had a near-death experience, that firmly believe there's nothing after I die can't possibly be. I mean, there's nothing on earth to indicate that we're going to continue to live, and there certainly can't be a God or any higher order in the universe, and boy, are they in for a shock when they have their near-death experience. It completely changes their perspective. Up until very recently, I would have had to have said that I have not encountered an atheist who was able to continue being an atheist after their NDE, but as with this type of research, every time you say always or never, you're wrong again. So recently I did get one NDE from an atheist who remarkably was able to continue to be an atheist in spite of the experience with overwhelming evidence, I think, that would be convincing to virtually anybody that there really is a higher order to things and a God, and yet this atheist continued to profess that they were an atheist.
Why doesn't science admit that there's that strong possibility that there's something on the other side, that there could be this other dimension or whatever plane of existence? But they won't do that. They won't go that extra mile because they don't have the hard data to do it.
Well, you know, it's really, George, to me as a scientist, that's one of the great mysteries of my life. I think as a scientist, what you're supposed to do if you apply the scientific method correctly is you make observations, and good gosh has that been done in the NDE community. I mean, literally thousands of these NDEs have been recorded by a variety of individuals and organizations. Very clearly, this thing is, you know, you look at the, read all these accounts, very clearly and unquestionably, the most obvious hypothesis is exactly what the near-death experiencers think happened, and that is they went over to the other side. And certainly that's entirely consistent with all the accounts that have been shared, and yet for some reason, the scientific and medical community seems to want to dissociate what seems to be an obvious conclusion from the data present without having any real alternative explanation, if you will, for what happens with NDEs. In fact, it's almost comical. Over 20 physiological or psychological, quote, explanations, unquote, of near-death experience have been advanced over the years by the scientific and medical community. The reason for that's clear. No one or several of these physiological or psychological explanations makes any sense even to the scientists or physicians that believe that they can't be, you know, what the NDEers are telling us all that they are. So I don't understand why scientists seem to be so rigorous and so open to scientific discoveries for virtually everything else except in the field of the paranormal. And I don't understand that. It really is seemingly inconsistent with what scientists should be doing.
Do the science have any special tools to try to register the NDEs?
Well, really, the only thing that's being done is what I'm doing. I have, of course, a website, near-death experience website. We have a very detailed questionnaire on the website that we ask our NDEers to fill out. So it helps us to know a great deal about the details of the experience, what occurred during the experience, what their life was like afterwards. And that's probably the best thing you can do. And that's scientific. You start by making the observations. And the next thing you do is draw correlations. What does the data mean? And that's what there's certainly been a lot of publications done. That's certainly what I'm active in doing. And again, no matter how you look at it, no matter what group of NDEs you get or from what source, it all points one way, that there seems to be an afterlife. It's wonderful. And that conclusion seems to be striking and holding up, even in spite of this most recent article.
Any correlation between those that have this apparent violent NDE as opposed to somewhat natural?
You mean those that have an NDE associated with
Let's say like an accident or something like that.
Oh, there's no correlation between the life-threatening event and what the experience turns out to be. It makes no difference if you have. In fact, that's actually been studied in one of the biggest NDE studies. That was a group of people that had a heart attack. Whether these people were aware the heart attack was happening and frightened, obviously, mm-hmm. as you would normally be, or if the heart attack happened so suddenly that there was, you know, basically, boom, lights out, you have no chance to be afraid or frightened, absolutely no difference in the probability that an NDE would occur in either of those two groups, and no difference whatsoever in the content of the NDE. And we see that over and over, whether it's an auto accident, whether it's warfare, whether it's just someone is struck by lightning or what have you, all
it,
across.
It just has no boundaries,
no
does
boundaries.
It? Stay with us, Jeffrey. We'll be back. Dr. Jeffrey Long on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Jeffrey Long. Jeffrey, did you ever have a near-death experience? I think you did a long time ago.
No, I never really had a near-death experience. I had a experience that was exceptional, somewhat similar to a near-death experience in some ways, but I've never really had a personal near-death experience. I just got interested in this by finding it in the medical literature and then by encountering a friend's wife who had an experience once, but never really had the situation where I had it myself.
How did you get interested in this field?
Well, that was a good question. Back when I was doing my residency training, which is the specialty training in medicine, if you will, I was going through a medical journal looking for a cancer-related article, and lo and behold, there was an article that talked about near-death experience. And of course, in medical school, we were never taught about that, and I was so busy in my studies, I never really listened to any of the media outlets where you could hear about it, and I was immediately impressed. I said, what does this mean? The title shocked me. I read the article and was immediately astonished. Here it was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the biggest journals in the world in the field of medicine. And apparently, even at this time, which was in the early days of the NDE, back in the early 1980s, apparently thousands of these experiences existed. People had very similar experiences. I knew at that point in time in my medical training, when you're dead, you're dead. You can't have a conscious experience. I mean, there's not even a potential neurologically or physiologically to even have any thoughts, let alone something so ordered and so dramatic and so life-changing, as often happens for NDEers. So that I guess, was my initial bit of hearing about it. I remember thinking vividly, gosh, why aren't more people researching it? Little did I know. That would be my niche someday.
Do you have a similarity of traits with people who have NDEs? Do they come back and describe what they might have seen?
Certainly the experience elements are very, very consistent. NDEers come from all walks of life, of course, so there's not a lot of common characteristics of them before the experience. But after the experience, they tend to have what are referred to as after effects. They come back almost strikingly, most obvious thing is that they don't fear death. It's very rare for these individuals, which is startling when you think about it. And these are people that nearly died, or in some places they were clinically gone. You would think they would fear death to have lived through that and know just how awful it can be. You know, the life, the physical trauma that led to them having an NDE would have to be frightening. And yet they don't fear death because of their awareness of what's going to happen after they die, their belief in that. In addition to that, when they come back, they have other common belief systems. They come back being less materialistic. Very noticeably, they're far more loving in their relationships to other people. They're far more interested in unworldly things. They'll spend more time in thoughts and prayer, meditation, if you will. So these are all characteristics that NDEers very commonly have.
How would you categorize this situation? Somebody, let's say, is involved in a car accident, rushed to the hospital, and she has an out-of-body experience and explains exactly what was going on in the medical room, in the emergency room at the time. What would you call that? Is that an NDE as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that would be a life-threatening event. And what you're describing occurs in about half of the near-death experiences. The technical fancy word for it's veridical perception, but all that really means is that they've had an out-of-body experience and they can see and usually hear what's going on around them at the time that they're unconscious and maybe even clinically dead. That is one of the most impressive things about NDEs that I have noticed. Medically speaking, what these people observe is dead right on medically. In other words, that's exactly what happens. It's not like on TV, or it's not like any other source that they could have this. Sometimes these codes, when they occur, when people's heart stops and their breathing stops, they're not clean, they're not slick, they're not like what they're on TV. There's often some unprofessional behavior. There can be tears. The equipment tends not to be around. There's either too many people or not enough people to get the code run right. And that's what these people are seeing, and that's startling. And certainly other people that have had near-death experiences that had that so-called out-of-body experience and saw what was going on, either in the room or sometimes even geographically remote, every time, with one exception in my series of NDEers, that they went and tried to verify what they saw, they confirmed that what they saw was absolutely correct, and that is absolutely medically inexplicable.
Does it blow doctors' minds when they're told what this patient had witnessed and seen? He says things like, oh, doctor, I saw you do this or that, or you said this about me.
Yeah, it sure does. It's startling, is interesting. I love reading about that, of course, as a physician, when near-death experiencers confront their doctors or other members of their healthcare team about what happened. And sometimes it's amusing. Sometimes they're you know, some unprofessional contact. Yeah, the doctor's reaction to this is generally they're in awe, they're shocked. They'll usually be dismissive of it because they don't understand it, and of course they're always worried about. Sometimes they saw some things, they worry about being nailed for malpractice for what happened, and more often than not, more doctors will tend to not want to talk about it with the near-death experience, which is a real tragedy. I mean, we were talking about this earlier. Here is the doctor's best evidence right in their face that something absolutely incredible, phenomenal, medically inexplicable mm-hmm. happened, and they don't want to deal with it.
No,
they don't want to talk about it, and they don't want to read it.
Why is that, Jeffrey? Are they afraid of it?
I think they are. I think all of us have a natural tendency to fear the unknown. We all have a tendency to disbelieve things that are outside of our day-to-day reality, and I think especially for doctors. I mean, this is so different from what they encounter on a day-to-day basis. Almost no medical schools teach about this, and so as a result of that, when they see this, they try to use their medical background to explain it in some lame way, you know, a hallucination, bull. You know, the bottom line is, and you don't need an MD or a PhD or any initials after your name, George. I mean, all your listeners know, if you have an out-of-body experience and what you see and hear is real while you're clinically dead, that is a phenomena that is inexplicable. That is incredible.
Why do some people say that they see loved ones during this trip?
That's about, probably around a fourth to a third of these folks see loved ones. And that's the amazing thing, is that these with absolutely no... Well, I think with one exception out of the hundreds of NDEers I've seen that have shared with our website, when they see loved ones during the experience, and it's usually later on in the experience. I mean, they have that out-of-body state. But then when they go over to unearthly realms and they're in that part of the experience, that's where they can encounter their loved ones. But they're not loved ones that are alive at the time they had the near-death experience. If there was any earthly explanation for NDE, you would expect them to see people who were alive when they had this experience. But almost uniformly, these are all people that are deceased. And this isn't scary. It's not like seeing a ghost. The thing that impresses most of the NDEers when they encounter their loved ones is that it's just like a reunion. It's joyous. There's a great sharing of love. There's communication. If the person who died, their loved one died, had some physical abnormality, or they were debilitated, or crippled in any way, that's not present in their when they encounter their deceased relatives on the other side. Their health is flawless, and even if there was some interpersonal issues between them, it's all gone when they encounter the loved ones on the other side. It's just a nothing short of an absolutely joyous reunion.
How come we always hear the stories of they're told, go back, go back? Do we ever hear stories of the loved ones saying, come on, come on?
You know what? Not very often. That's usually the part of the near-death experience that occurs near the end. There's often a decision about whether to stay in these heavenly realms or to go back to Earth. And sometimes the relatives are there, and very often the relatives will say, very typically, it's not your time. The amazing thing is that these NDEers, these people that have died, that have spent years to decades in this earthly existence, just with the enormity of the beauty, the joy, the peace, the sense that they're home, when they're on the other side, even, you know, no matter what the circumstances of their NDE, the great majority of NDEers don't want to go back. And they will argue, they'll fight, if you will, verbally, they'll try to work with the beings on the other side to let them know they really, really want to stay. They don't want to go back to Earth. They feel like they're home. And so that's very often they hear the impression, often from deceased loved ones or from other beings that are there, go back. You have to go back. It's not your time. And so that, unfortunately, is why NDEers come back, and they often have a lot of adjustment trouble with that. They really want to stay. They don't want to come back to Earth where they feel encumbered, where things aren't peaceful and loving and beautiful like it is on the other side. It's very difficult on them to come back.
Does anybody ever report demonic spirits or anything like that trying to grab them in that kind of state?
Now, about 2% or 1 out of 50.
That's not a lot.
No, very rare, but we do get that. And again, out of the hundreds and hundreds of NDEs we have, we've got a little bit of a population. And there are some, and those are the actual so-called hellish NDEs, where there are actual demonic things or frightening things happen. You know, George, I used to love reading fiction and, you know, even scary stories
sure.
back when I was a kid. But these, some of these things that they encounter are so frightening, they blow away anything I've ever read. I mean, this is really, I mean, when you say hellish, I mean that in every sense.
Give us an example, Jeffrey, if you would.
There could be some examples of, they could be, oh gosh, just, there, I mean, you name it, there's a variety. Just to pick one that, actually this was from a story of an NDEer we had on Coast to Coast quite a while ago. Consciousness was floating through this tunnel-like area, sort of a passageway, and there were a variety of doors on both sides. And her consciousness, her name was Sarah, went into this area and saw this horrible, usually there's foul smells, and this was going on there. I mean, it's just instantly horrible smells. And there's also, beyond just the visuals, there's a huge sense of foreboding, of dread. You can actually, the communication in these near-death experiences often, in fact, generally telepathic, so you get a sense of the fear, the horror, the nightmare that's going on there. And there were all these beings down there, animals, beings, all of them just in hellish fire was going on there. And I don't want anyone to go away thinking at all, as we talk about these hellish experiences, which can be absolutely dramatic and vivid. The NDEers that encounter these and talk about them almost invariably say that that the people in these realms, in these awful environments, all they have to do is choose not to be there. They just have to basically ask or turn to
them. I was going to say, does the NDEer create this himself?
That seems to be the best explanation as to what's going on, and that's very consistent for many NDEers. There's some people that even on the other side, you know, even with vastly higher consciousness than we have here, for some reason, out of guilt, out of anger, out of, you know, some major, major characteristic flaws, just seem to create, if you will. And we, you know, that's the issue with free will that NDEers are very clear on. We have, especially on the other side, the ability to choose what we want to be, where we want to be, our environment. And for whatever reason, for whatever huge flaws these rare individuals have, they choose to create this environment for themselves. It is not eternal. It is not something that punishment, it is not something being forced on them. It's just something they have to go through, apparently by their own choice. And when they so choose, they can leave and return to the heavenly realms that are much more familiar in NDE accounts.
What do you tell people now, patients, people you work with, about their near-death experiences? How do they handle it?
Well, early on, people are, of course, they're recovering from their life-threatening event, and usually that's very much on the forefront of their mind. But then after a while, they kind of go, well, what happened? And it's usually they're very slow to share it because it's such an incredible experience. They actually fear a negative reaction by their doctors, by their healthcare team. It actually takes near-death experiencers an average of about 7 years to fully integrate this dramatic experience into their life.
That long?
It really does. And the reason is because a response to what the evidence that has been so graphically shown to them during their experience, you know, you can't have that and respond to that without having some major changes in your value system, your loss of fear of death, more loving attitudes towards others, change, any kind of change, even if it's you've got a dramatic catalyst like an NDE, is still very, very difficult. That's human nature. And sometimes it's easier for people to just put the experience in the back of their mind and not respond to it. But ultimately, most NDEers do. They say, I learned something. I understand, at least qualitatively, why I'm here on Earth. I need to do something about that. I need to change my life in response to what I now know is the greater reality. And after some difficulty, they have the courage to actually make that change.
By crossing over to a point, do you open up a portal where some of these demonic spirits can come through?
No. We're in no danger at all, here of us on Earth, from these demonic spirits. There's absolutely no shred of NDE evidence on that at all. These heavenly or rare hellish realms are all that which is on the other side. I wish we could have a little piece of heaven here on Earth. Boy, if we could open up a portal and bring down some of these enormous beauty, love, peace, wisdom, understanding, joy, reunions that are on the other side. Oh gosh, I'd be first in line, George, but it just doesn't work that way. It's really that which is on the other side, which we can choose or not choose to do. That's the portal. It's not accessible to us here.
What's the difference between people who suffer NDEs in this country as opposed to, let's say, China or some other area?
Well, that's a startling thing. Our website devoted to NDE It's been translated into over 20 different foreign languages. A major thrust of our research has been to collect NDEs from countries all around the world, and we actually have, we must have at least several hundred non-English NDEs. And we now have a population of about a dozen, maybe more, NDEs that are actually in non-Western civilizations. They're not Judeo-Christian backgrounds. These were people living in these non-Western civilizations at that time, at the time they had their NDE. And that's what's so startling. They're remarkably similar to the NDEs that we have in the Western world. I mean, there can be a few minor differences, but it's far more striking that the similarities of the elements are there.
Are some people embarrassed or uncomfortable to talk about their NDE experiences?
Oh, absolutely. It's very, very hard to share something. First of all, you know, understand they've had the most dramatic experience in their life. How would you feel if you tried to share with someone the most dramatic thing that ever happened and they didn't understand it?
Or they didn't believe it.
Or they called you a liar, or they said you must have been dreaming or hallucinating. And that unfortunately happens a lot. So they're afraid of other people's reactions. I think a lot of it, of course, it takes 7 years to fully integrate it. They may not fully understand the implications of the experience in their own life themselves. And it's just such an overwhelming thing that it's just very, very hard to do. And then finally, gosh, a lot of these NDEs, to really fully share the whole experience, you've got to have someone listening for a good 30 minutes, 45 minutes or more, because these experiences can be so dramatic, so prolonged, and have so many details. I mean, they're not just simple things you can share in 5 minutes generally.
No question in your mind that there is life after death.
Now, again, every person has to make up their own mind. But for me, and George, I actually set up my NDE website because I wanted to know scientifically. I said, what can NDE tell me? I didn't want to read books. I didn't want to listen to any third-party source. I said, go to the original source of the evidence. That was 8 years ago, and I would say, as a scientist, as a physician, based on my best judgment from the evidence that I have at hand, that my conclusion is definitely there is life after death.
Stay with us, Dr. Jeffrey Long. In a moment, we're going to bring in Kim Sharp. She had an NDE. And then later on tonight, we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to introduce to you Kim Sharp. Then we'll have Dr. Long explain why she's with us this hour. Kim Sharp is the founder of the Seattle International Association of Near-Death Studies. It's the world's oldest, largest support group for near-death experiencers since 1982. She's been published in many journals, textbooks, magazines, and is an international conference and workshop speaker, as well as a consultant to the news and entertainment industry. In addition, she's the author of After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose. Kim is also known for some remarkable experiences after her own NDE. Now let's go to Dr. Jeffrey Long as well. But Kim, hi, and welcome to Coast. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a good show.
Jeffrey, tell us Kim's experience and why she's with us tonight.
Well, you know, of course, we're talking about near-death experience, and Kim has certainly had a very dramatic near-death experience. And then as we were talking about how near-death experiences changes people, how they view the world differently, how they tend to respond to their near-death experience in some very positive ways. Whenever you think about someone who is exemplary and how their life changed, you really think of Kim.
All right, Kim, tell us a little bit about this NDE you had.
Well, I was in perfect health with my dad in Shawnee Mission, Kansas, a shout-out there, at the Department of Motor Vehicles, getting my first auto license. And really, from my dad's perspective, which isn't mine, I don't remember much except waiting for my number to come up, which was my introduction into the dying process, irony. And but apparently I did everything appropriately, and as we were stepping out the door, I collapsed, and my dad tried to catch me, but I hit the sidewalk. There happened to be a uniformed nurse passing by. She determined that I didn't have a pulse, so the Shawnee Mission Volunteer Fire Department, as well as ambulance personnel at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, came a-running, and the volunteer firefighters arrived first. They had a new portable ventilator that had two features, one, of course, to ventilate, the other to actually suck the air out of the person if someone is choking on, you know, candy or a piece of lettuce.
Right.
So, again, according to my dad, they slapped the apparatus on my face, which is a tight seal, by the way, flipped the switch on, and it was on, basically sucked the life out of her mode. It was on the reverse vacuum. So,
now, how old were you?
I was 22 and 3 days.
All right, so you got your license late.
This was my auto license for my first car. I had no
not driver's license.
Right.
Okay.
But I wasn't driving before then anyway.
All right.
So it was a twofer. But this was, in this particular instance, it was my auto license.
Okay.
I didn't have a car, but I was going to get one. So I'm in my dad's memory, not mine, so it's harder to retrieve. They knew something was wrong right away. They flipped the switch. Air was pushed back into my body. But that violent thrust of air just went everywhere, not necessarily to my lungs. And I blew up like a flesh balloon. I literally expanded.
Oh, God.
And that's called epithelial emphysema.
And you're in the hospital by this time, right?
No, I'm on the sidewalk.
You're still on the sidewalk. Oh, my.
Yeah, and in a rather smallish community at the time in Kansas, this was like public theater. So this was not uninterrupted or unobserved. This was a growing crowd.
We had witnesses here.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And anyway, to shorten the story, the medics said to my dad, there's nothing more we can do, which I'm married to an outstanding Seattle paramedic, recently retired, and that's medic speak for she's dead.
All right, tell me this is the one who tended to you. That would make the story more strange.
There were two or three people attending to me, as well as the uniformed nurse was still there. Anyway, from the back of this crowd by this time, I guess, came a man. He was swearing like a mule skinner. In that part of the country, that's really not an insult. But anyway, he was swearing, and he pulled the firefighters off of me and did what we now would call CPR. This was in 1970, though, and CPR, as we now know it today, was just developing, in fact, in Seattle with Medic One.
How did he know it? And the firefighters did not. And the EMT people did not.
Don't know. But that's what he did. And
all right.
It was to no avail anyway, because then, again, with colorful language, he told my dad he wasn't getting a blankety-blank thing. So we're calling that the second give-up situation. Then my dad's memory goes away, but the ambulance came. There was a cheer in the crowd. I was unconscious but breathing on my own. Got taken to St. Luke's. Things went sour in the ER, I guess, but I came back, and the time that passed, my father was a very careful attorney, and the time that passed was an hour and a half from when we stepped out of the DMV and I came around in the emergency room of the medical center.
What caused you to collapse, by the way, Kim?
Well, I've pulled my medical records so someone named George wouldn't interview me tonight. No, I pulled my medical records in preparation of writing the book After the Light. Thank you for the plug, by the way.
Oh, that's right.
And by the time I got to the emergency room, my primary problem had become respiratory. So the medical notes state that the primary reason for collapsing was disguised in a myriad of other respiratory and neurological problems. But probably, and this was again in the chart, that it was a simple faint, and for some reason my blood pressure dropped, or I went into some kind of cardiac event. That hasn't happened since. Certainly if this happened today in Seattle, there would be a lot more information available that there wasn't then in the Midwest.
All right. In the state you were in, did you see anything strange with this NDE?
Yes.
What was it?
Oh, come on. Well, for the benefit of healthcare providers and loved ones who might be by a dying body, the first thing I could remember was hearing a woman's voice to my left saying, "I'm not getting a pulse, I'm not getting a pulse." And I don't remember seeing anything, but I felt like I was speaking with her as clearly as I'm speaking with you now, as a matter of fact, and she was ignoring me, so I gave up, which...
What do you mean you gave up?
I don't want to say I was frustrated, it was just, but I was. I don't, you know, I've jokingly referred to this as my near-death snip, but she would not acknowledge the fact that I was clearly saying that I wouldn't be speaking to her if I did not have a pulse. And that she was getting more agitated was agitating. So I just decided I was out of there, but I don't remember making a decision. But I found myself next in a very warm environment surrounded by grayness. And
not grays, the people, the beings that we talk about all the time, just grayness,
I wasn't alone, and I really, truly believe that I was someplace. I've come to, just as a human at my age now, think that maybe this is a corridor of consciousness we all go through, because grayness is kind of an iconic aspect of almost dying. It's reflected in literature and movies, yada, yada.
But. Could you see structure to it, or just... No.
Well, yes, in a way, because I could, quote-unquote, see that it was, this grayness was made up of flints or glints of brilliant light, like a lighter would give off without a flame.
All right.
Mixed up in a mass of what I used to call bottomless pits, but now I would say like black holes. They had depth. There was dimension. And that was interesting, but I was distracted by the fact that I was warm and that I felt like I was waiting for something. And I might add here, what I'm about to say, I don't say lightly or with very good vocabulary, because what happened next was divine, but in the expression of a light that, for lack of a better word, just exploded around me and encompassed everything with I was right at the very center, and I could, again, with quotes, see. I was seeing, however, George, but I mean, I don't know how to explain this, but I could see this light going out in all directions, but at the same time, endlessly layering back on itself. And I had cognition in the fact that I felt like I was beholding eternity, so it wasn't just in a linear fashion, but it was in dimensions, and it was endless, and that I had come from someplace, I was going to someplace, it was all right, and such intense love. I don't think I could have responded.
Were you aware that you were dying?
No, at that time, all I could be aware of was... Well, what I said, and again, I put it in quotes, was homey home. And interesting that Jeff Long was talking about that feeling of being home. But homey home, I later learned from my parents, is what I used to say when I was a toddler learning language and we'd been away from the house and we're driving back into the neighborhood, and I would recognize certain neighborhood milestones, and I would say, homey home, homey home. And so it was a Gucci Goo moment for my parents. I don't remember ever saying that personally. But,
a Gucci Goo moment?
Well, you know, when parents are think that their child is just the cutest thing ever born moment. So when I would say homie home, they thought that was adorable.
Did you see anything of that scared you during this period?
Not yet. So after forever, I was in this light, and I can refer people to, I mean, I'm not trying to plug After the Light, but, I mean, that's a much longer book than I'll have time to talk with you this evening. But, I mean, in greater detail, my near-death experience is certainly in that book. It kicks off the whole point of After the Light. But for radio's sake, I was in that experience forever with the light, and there was communication, and I asked questions any fool would ask. I got answers that were like remembering, and then I was told I had to go back. I argued. I lost that argument. I was sent back. I found myself about the distance of 4 feet from my own body, lying on the ground, and in my perspective, I was lying next to it by about 4 feet. And my very first reaction after what is certainly the most secret experience of my life so far was a joke, because I'd actually flunked my driver's test, ergo working on both licenses. And it was because I couldn't parallel park within 4 feet of the curb. So my first reaction was, I can't even park myself. And that's pretty light in terms of a response, but it was, I think, my way of reacting to a complete shock, because me, Kim, was not in that, what we would call, body.
How did this change your life when you came out of it?
In a way that I had to stare at myself in the mirror and try to figure out what was different about me. I had plans. They evaporated. They involved staying in Kansas and settling down and being taken care of. And instead, I passed my driver's license and got a car. And I had a life preview at the end of my near-death experience, which we've covered about half of, if that. But just FYI. And part of it involved seeing a place where mountains met waters, so it wasn't Kansas. And I got my hamster Toto in a birdcage in the front seat, and we headed west because that's where the mountains were. And that's when the profound effect of leaving home and...
Kim, I got to stop you right now. I am so lost from your near-death experience.
Well, you asked me the question about how it changed me. It changed me because I left the Midwest, wound up in Seattle, being a social worker, MSW, with an expertise in death and dying and an expertise in near-death experiences.
Let me bring you in, Jeffrey. Do you follow this at all?
Yeah, I'm familiar with her experience. You know, certainly a lot of NDEs are, the characteristic is commonly ineffable or difficult to describe in words. And this is just an example that sometimes it's a little hard to, you know, put an experience that is so dramatic and unearthly in earthly terms. But Kim did, you know, certainly have a, you know, cardiopulmonary arrest. Her heart and breathing stopped. She was resuscitated, and she felt that she needed to, in some way, respond, as I understand, Kim, to what happened. You felt a calling, or you actually, during your near-death experience at the end, we talked a little bit briefly about some people having psychic abilities where they can see future events. And as I understand, Kim, that was part of what you went through. In other words, as part of your near-death experience, you were aware that something was going to happen in the future in which you would have to geographically be apart from Kansas.
Exactly, because what I saw myself doing was being of service in a place where mountains met water.
And that's very different from where you thought you'd spend your life with your upper-class upbringing.
A 180. And when I talk about my near-death experience, my apologies, I'm speaking from the heart, and that means it's not rehearsed or in any kind of a can whatsoever. And it's not an easy interview to do because we're on the radio and words are so hard to find, and I get lost in the experience.
No, that's okay, Kim. That's okay. And because we've got you here, Jeffrey, to explain some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight. I mean, other people, though, that we've talked to about near-death experiences have had a more specific, I guess, vision in what happened to themselves. She seems to be in that movie, What Dreams May Come. Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Where it, you know, it was just more of a mosaic of things. Yet other people have had, you know, specific things happen to themselves.
Yeah, no two NDEs are the same. And a lot of what Kim, for example, is describing as light is not like light the way we know it on Earth. I would suspect that there was intense emotions, intense love associated with the light, things that you just really, you know, are so non-ordinary, they're hard to describe, even if, though it happened to Kim decades ago. Do I got that right, Kim?
And, I mean, it could be reduced to love or God or, it doesn't matter. It's back to words and how difficult such love and personal as well as universal and timeless love exists. It's beyond what we can possibly describe, and certainly life-altering.
And I got to believe, just by the things that she's talking about, it has altered her life dramatically, Jeffrey. Jeff, the websites we've got for you, we've got three. Any specific ones you'd recommend people go to?
Yeah, probably the biggest one for NDE is the www.nderf.org. That's the website for the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation.
All right, well, stick with us, Jeff. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines where you can share some of your NDE experiences with us. If you need to email me, that's always simple. It's george@coasttocoastam.com, or also get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and peruse it all the time. Also, a lot of you will always send me emails the next day saying, I missed his website. Where is it? All you have to do is go to show info. It's on the left-hand side of the coasttocoastam.com website. Click that, and then when that opens up, you click guests, and then like this particular case, you go to Dr. Jeffrey Long. Everything is down there alphabetically. You get to his name, and all his websites are listed. And we've got that with every guest that's on the program, whether it's Sean David Morton or David Icke, you name it, Dr. Turi. All their websites are always listed there, and you'll always be able to find them. I'll be back in a moment. Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Long on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Jeffrey Long here. Jeffrey, is there a difference between Western and non-Western culture with NDEs?
You know, that's a good question, because you'd know if someone from a non-Western civilization, if their NDE was related to their prior life experience, their belief systems, their religious background, any of that, you would expect that to show up in their NDE, and you would expect that it would be different from Western civilization, or if you will, American NDEs. But the really interesting thing is, and I've looked at a population of these things, and there's a few other authors that have written about this, as best I can tell, the similarities are far more striking than the differences. They have out-of-body experiences, they have life reviews, they see a light, they feel great love and intense positive feelings, and so that's the amazing thing about this, is that no matter where you have an NDE, anywhere in the world, there may be some differences, but by far and away, the similarities are far more striking.
The fact, though, that there are these cultural differences and changes, what does that tell you about some of the differences?
Well, I think as far as I'm concerned, you have to look at, you know, why are there a little bit of cultural differences. First of all, they're subtle. Especially in certain civilizations that are underdeveloped, primitive. There was actually an interesting study of NDEs and the Australian Aborigines, interestingly enough. I think it tells me, as a scientist, it helps me to understand why are NDEs happening. I think they're co-created events. I think the NDEer that's having the experience has some contribution to the experience, but there's also a component to the experience by something else, that higher consciousness, or if you will, something the higher power, divine. So I think that would explain both the similarities and the differences.
But what would you tell a scientist who said there is no such thing as the afterlife?
I would say, let's look at the evidence. I would say that's what we do with everything else in science and medicine, and NDEs should really be no different. First of all, to a scientist, I would say it's impossible to have a highly conscious experience while you're unconscious. As the name implies, unconscious, no conscious thought possible, and yet that's when these things happen. We talked a little bit earlier about the out-of-body experience, where what you see around your body, and sometimes it's even in an area away from your body in a different room, almost invariably exactly what's going on. That's impossible unless your consciousness has actually separated. I'd also say, what about near-death experiences in the blind, including blind from birth? That should be absolutely impossible, and yet those that are blind, including blind from birth, can have visual near-death experiences. And we've had one such lady, Vicky, on a prior Coast to Coast show. And then recently we got a gentleman who was deaf, profoundly deaf, from birth, who at the age of 10, when he came very, very close to drowning, was able to communicate without sign language with his deceased relatives. Absolutely inexplicable. You look into the positive changes that follow NDEs, you look at what the near-death experiencers say is happening, and that is that there's a visit to the other side. You look at the evidence in totality and the fact that there's really not a lot of conflicting evidence that's been identified, and you've really got a extremely strong case that NDEs are the real thing.
How many NDEs talk about the other side in terms of the hell portion? You know, we talked a little bit about that last hour. But, I mean, do they ever really say that they believe that there is this place of evil?
That's an interesting idea. A lot of NDEers that don't encounter hellish realms in their experience, and I might add some NDEs are mixed. Very often there's sort of a view or a sense or an awareness at a distance of hellish realms, and then they go on and have a very pleasant, positive, loving NDE. Of NDEers that don't have these types of visions or awareness of these hellish realms, very often they'll come back and say, there is no hellish realm. And you know what? They're absolutely correct. In other words, from their reality, from their perspective, it can't exist. And to some degree, they're correct because, again, as we were saying earlier, these hellish realms seem to be a choice that you make on the other side. It's something that you can enter willingly and that you can leave willingly. I mean, why on earth anybody would do that on the other side, I still find a little bit startling. But that's the evidence that scores of NDEers come back. And their opinion on that is so consistent that even though it's a little difficult to understand to me personally, I have to think there's some truth to it.
Why do you have to die or get close to dying to have an NDE? Why can't we induce it?
Boy, I tell you, if we could induce an NDE simply and safely, wouldn't that be outstanding? Well, how nice that would be to take away all your doubt about the afterlife, all the fear of your own death or the death of a loved one or wondering what happened to someone that we've loved that died. How good that would be, but unfortunately, we just can't. There's nothing on earth that will reproduce an NDE. And believe me, I've looked for that. In fact, that's one of the questions I ask on my survey of near-death experiencers. Has anything in your life reproduced any element of the near-death experience? That's worded deliberately so that people will think and answer yes if there's anything at all, and yet the great, great majority say no. Those that do think that there's some, you know, remote relationship to NDE, meditation is probably number one. Other near-death experiences, of course, are can occur. Occasionally, people have two or more near-death experiences. But really, the bottom line, nothing reproduces anywhere close to the totality of the near-death experience. So with regrets, I have to conclude, you know, we really have to nearly die before we're really going to have a near-death experience.
What about religion? Does that play a factor here? I mean, if you are very religious, do you tend to have them more, or do you not?
No correlation at all. Your religious background, what your beliefs are, what denomination, whether it's Judeo-Christian or something totally unrelated, Buddhist, doesn't make any difference in whether or not what your probability is of having a near-death experience. Furthermore, it doesn't even seem to have a huge impact on the elements of the experience. You still go through the same thing. In fact, even if you're an atheist, as we've discussed, even if you absolutely believe that when you die, you're dead and gone, well, that's probably the best news these atheists ever had in their life, that have a near-death experience, so they can see firsthand, experience for their own life, sense in their own way that life really, really does go on, and it's wonderful.
I bet, though, as we were talking, that some of these atheists, once they have a real experience like this, they tend to change.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how you could go through an experience like this, and I'm sure your listeners feel the same way. You know, go through a typical NDE that has the love, the light, the life review, see your whole life, meet the deceased relatives, have all that components of an amazing experience, and come back and say, oh, there is no other side. It was all an illusion. The NDEers will typically believe that their experience to them is more real than even what goes on in our daily lives. In fact, it's not unusual, George, for NDEers to say, look, my NDE happened 20 years ago, and that NDE is more real to me than what happened to me yesterday. I mean, there's that profound a sense of reality associated with these experiences.
Like some movies in Hollywood, Jeffrey, I think eventually we'll be able to download memory and thought from one's brain onto a computer and maybe see pictures of what they're imagining or seeing. Wouldn't that be something if we were able to do that with people who are having NDEs to see what this heaven state might look like or whatever dimension they end up going into?
I think that would be absolutely incredible. My sense is that the experience is so profound it would be very, very difficult to reproduce in the three-dimensional world NDEers often say that they're going to a different dimension or there's multiple dimensions, and so it would be very, very difficult to convey that in pictures, in words, but certainly you can come close. Some NDEers are able to draw pictures of their experience, and they're amazing. We've had, other NDEers express their NDE through music or in other ways or in poetry. I've had others do that. It's almost that the experience is so profound and mystical that you have to really dig into the artistic side, if you will, to really fully express what's going on.
Some shamans, maybe under the influence of this beverage, ayahuasca, part of a plant in South America, Central America, might be able to induce this.
Well, I think that they induce, certainly they induce the out-of-body experience or that they believe that they do. Some of the experiences that shamans can have can certainly be similar to NDEs. I actually was curious about that some time ago. On our NDE website, a fairly substantial number, about 24 people actually, have shared what were clearly drug-related experiences. These were illicit drugs. They were clearly not near death, not significantly physically compromised, but they obviously thought their experience was close enough to an NDE that they went through the considerable effort to share their drug experience on an NDE website. So, scientist that I am, I sat down and compared what their experience was like, the elements of their experience, for those that had drugs and compared it directly to NDEers answering the exact same questions. The result of that is clearly there was a difference that was statistically different between the group that had NDEs and the group that had drug experiences. So at least from my point of view, even people that have NDEs that are associated or that have experiences that are associated with drugs, even if they think they're like NDEs, they're really not. I think that's probably true of the shamans, although it's hard to say. People have the most amazing experience. There's probably some shamans that have, some experiences that are certainly like or very similar to NDE, but I strongly doubt that that's the norm.
Would the drug extract DMT might do this?
Certainly that's been the subject of a lot of speculation. DMT theoretically being a drug that can act in the brain and reproduce near-death experiences or at least some significant elements of that. I think those of us that have, and it's a little complex because you're getting into neural pathways and, you get into pharmacology and some pretty fancy medical stuff, but as a conclusionary statement, those of us that are physicians in the NDE research committee, research arena, really doubt that DMT or any other chemical, if you will, either that you take illicitly or take legally, or any other chemical acting into the brain, and they're referred to as endogenous chemicals, that being naturally produced chemicals in the brain, none of us, I believe, at all that this in any way significantly reproduces near-death experiences.
What's the future hold for your particular field?
Well, for near-death experience research, I think there's a few things that we need to try to do. I think we need to get more people interested in near-death experience research. One of the things that you can do is study that out-of-body experience. We talked about earlier how often the initial part of the NDE or consciousness is apart from the body, and what you can see and hear very often from a level above your body seems to be unbelievably accurate, amazingly, at a time that you're unconscious and clinically dead. Well, the idea has been obtained to put a target up near the ceiling level, facing the ceiling, where hopefully people that have an NDE would actually be able to see the target, which should be absolutely invisible or not seeable by anybody on the ground. And so if anybody had an NDE, had an out-of-body experience, and was able to see that target, that would be very, very strong evidence that their consciousness indeed was apart from the body. And there's some research on that that has been done and is ongoing, so that's one thing. I think doing what I'm going to do in the future with my NDE database of about 800 near-death experiences is nail down a little bit more of the consistency of the NDE experience. Sort of, if you will, put it down in writing, see how much variability there is, and just look at that a little bit more critically, and hopefully I will ultimately write a book about my findings and sort of say, look, as far as NDEs go, here's what seems to be the most consistent elements, the most consistent beliefs people have, and, here's, just to be totally fair and honest about this, here's where we see some variability in the information people bring back. I can tell you the consistency in the ideas people bring back about real critical issues like why are we on Earth, what's our meaning, what's our purpose here, are startlingly similar across all these hundreds and hundreds of NDEs. So this will be one very interesting book to write when I get all the research done.
It must be exciting and at the same time, I guess, pretty fulfilling, huh?
It is exciting. I think it's exciting because, you know, I guess I'm like everybody else. I mean, how many of us have sat here at one point in our life, or actually many points, and said, gosh, what happens when I die? I mean, that's going to happen.
I think everybody has said that, you know?
Everybody. That is the one common thing that I think any human that ever walked the earth has thought of. What happens when I die? Do I go away? Is this it? Is there nothing more? And so I think the NDE, which is best I can tell, is the strongest evidence that we do go on, that there is more, that there's a reason for us being here. There's a reason for our life. There's a reason for our death, that we don't die, that the very being that we are is a part of something far, far greater than ourselves. It is incredibly exciting. I mean, what more in science could you find that's more exciting than that? And that's why I'm so interested in doing this kind of research, obviously without funding. I have nothing for sale at this time, and we don't solicit donations, so it's a burden both in terms of time and financially, but I love doing it. It is so fascinating to me. And I just hope more and more people will share that interest in the scientific and medical community and in other professional interests, because I think there's an important message, an important learning thing for all of us. I mean, if we're all worried about what happens when we die, let's find the answers for that. NDEs, related experiences, look at all the evidence that's available. We need to answer that question.
You know, Daniel Brinkley died several times with his near-death experiences as well. You know, he talks about this incredible light and everything else. His life has changed because of it.
Daniel's life changed dramatically. I mean, he's very upfront about the type of individual he was before his NDE, and I don't think he was particularly proud of it.
But no, he didn't like who he was before that.
He did. Yeah, he absolutely didn't. He didn't like who he was, and you're right. He actually had two NDEs. He had a clinical death twice, and he's just, his life has turned around 180 degrees. I mean, you know, a true inspiration to those of us in NDE research, you know, NDEers in general. He's not at all shy about going around and talking about his near-death experience and what it's meant to him and how it's changed his life, and it's just dramatic.
You know, there's no question how it's got to have an effect on you when you come back. I mean, it's got to be huge.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, this is the singular, when people come back, the one thing they're very clear about is that this is the most significant, important, dramatic event that has happened in their life, no matter how old they are. And then to, you know, as they start to understand this and say, well, maybe this lifelong fear that I've had that we die and go away and there's nothing more to life, nothing more after we're dead, maybe I'm wrong. And they slowly start to think about that, and maybe during my life review, I not only reviewed my entire life to understand how my actions affect other people, but about a fourth of the life reviews, these NDEers actually feel how the other person felt that they were interacting with during their life review.
What's the percent, Jeffrey, about these NDEers? Are they afraid to die again?
No. About 95-98% are not afraid to die again. I mean, they faced a life-threatening event. You'd think they'd be afraid to go through that kind of physical trauma again, but they aren't. They are absolutely not afraid of death. Why? You want to know why they're not afraid of death? Because they believe they've seen the other side. They believe they know what will happen when they die again, and they're not at all afraid.
I wonder if people who are criminals, if in their NDEs, they come back with a different perspective as well.
Oh, absolutely. And we, of course, needless to say, have a number that were clearly criminals at the time they had their near-death experience, and very difficult, nasty people. Again, the life review will often allow them to see how their actions affected other people. They're not really judged during this part of the NDE, but it's more for their understanding. They see, they get, you know, that's not what they want to do for the rest of their life. So criminals can come back very, very changed people, just like any other NDEers. You know, we've had people go on in the helping professions, and it's just amazing the turnaround.
Stay with us. What a fast show. We'll be back for the final hour. We'll open up the phone lines. Questions for Dr. Jeffrey Long. And welcome back with Dr. Jeffrey Long. I'm George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey, the various organizations you are really affiliated with and work with, why are they separate? Why not just one big one?
You know, that's a good question. They're actually technically under one umbrella, corporate-wise, Consciousness Research Foundation, but because they are distinctly different experiences, we thought we'd split up the near-death experiences, the NDE Research Foundation, the OBEs, their out-of-body experience, to its separate research foundation, and then sort of after-death communication to a separate one. I think having them separate like that and separate websites helps people to, well, certainly to find them on the search engines where we're ranked 1, 2, and 2, respectively, on Google. And so it shares experiences, and I think it helps keep them separate, and then that I think it gives a stronger methodology when we compare these experiences with from a scientific point of view to have them, you know, basically shared on three different areas. We have different questions that are pertinent to after-death communications and out-of-body experiences that we also study.
Your questionnaire for your NDEs, is it a long questionnaire?
Yeah, I really respect people that want to take the time to fill that out, especially for the more elaborate NDEs. It's a long, long thing. It has over 120 different questions.
Why so many?
Because NDEs are so complex. There are so many different elements. No two of them are the same, and yet by having all these questions, we can compare groups of experiences. It helps us to learn about NDEs. We can compare NDEs to other types of experiences, and I think, at least from a scientific methodology point of view, I'm a lot more confident making the statements that I make here because we have such detailed data and because we're able to make such detailed comparisons of these groups of exceptional human experiences.
Most countries, of course, I'm sure the participants in, their citizens have NDEs, but is there any special a geographical region that has more than the others?
I haven't really seen anything like that, not that I'm aware of. I think an NDE will occur around 10 to 20% of the time that you have a life-threatening event. It's nowhere near 100%. So I think it's really proportional to where in the world you have, you know, a number of very serious life-threatening events. And then given 10 or 20% of those folks have an NDE, that's where you're going to get your folks that have them.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, hi. My name's Doug. I'm calling from Portland.
Sure, Doug. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Jeffrey, I had a question. I had an experience that was very, very dramatic to me. And I wouldn't call it an NDE, but more of an extraordinary experience, to use your terms. But it happened when I was, you know, drifting off to sleep, and it was kind of like my inner eye was open, and I plunged into my chest chakra, into my heart, with my eye, with my consciousness open. So I felt like I kind of pierced the veil, if you know, and I wondered if that has any relationship to what you're studying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, of course, not typical of a near-death experience element. People, I haven't heard any of that with an NDE, but, you know, clearly I can tell from the tone of your voice and how you're describing it that clearly was an exceptional experience. Uh-huh. And so, Doug, for you and actually for all listeners, I think most or nearly all of us have had an exceptional experience like what you described, Doug, and that certainly is exceptional. Uh-huh. I have to say, even though they don't fall under neatly into a particular category, they're still very important and very significant, even if we don't have the words to describe them. Uh-huh. It's certainly something, Doug, that you could learn from, consider, you know, was it real? Why was it real? How do you know that? What can I learn from the experience? How could this change me? How has it changed me? And then you'll have gone down the path that so many other NDEers and so many others that have had exceptional human experiences can have, and the results could be very, very positive.
Well, I can say that it's definitely it's still with me, and related experiences during that time period have stayed with me. And like you said, they're more real to me than some of the waking things that I still do.
Yeah, and that's exactly, Doug, a hallmark of these types of exceptional experiences is that as you're relaying it, I mean, you remember it. It's vivid in your memory. You know, and I know, if this were a dream, you wouldn't be remembering it like this, but you do, because it was exceptional, because there was that element of reality to it. So clearly that's an exceptional experience, and it can be one of your great life teachers, like any of our exceptional life experiences.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Hi, first-time caller. Hi, Dr. Long.
I had a near-death experience back in August of 1978. I was 26 years old at the time. I'm now 54.
Okay.
I'll be 54. And what you're saying about the vividness of it is very, very true. I could remember that. It's with me. It has been with me for all of these years more clearly than what I could remember of yesterday or last week. Now, when I had my near-death experience, it was right after an operation. I went to the clergy. I went to a Catholic priest. I went to a Baptist minister. And back then, of course, nobody really heard the term NDE. I didn't even know what happened. It wasn't until a few years later when it started coming out on television. And, you know, my husband grabbed me and says, "Hun, look, it's on television, what you were trying to tell me." And I mean, my jaw just dropped. But you do come away, like speaking for myself, I came away with two gifts. My husband tells me I have the gift of touch, of a healing touch, and a prophetic gift. And I've shared some of it, you know, with people. And it can be a gift and it can be a curse.
Are you glad you have it?
Sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. That's really impressive. You know, having gifts like that, like you describe, it's, you know, there's almost a sense that when you feel different from other people. I mean, you know, you have that's both a gift and yet, you know, it's, as you said, it's sometimes it's hard to say, especially with prophecy. Sometimes that can be a gift, or sometimes, gosh, do you really want to know? And that's what makes NDE so fascinating. You actually had your NDE in 1978, only 3 years after the first book by Dr. Raymond Moody first coined the term near-death experience in the book Life After Life. So I'm not surprised very, very few, if any, people heard about it at that point in time. And I'm just really, you know, glad you hung in there. It took a lot of courage to share it back then. And, you know, now it's a household word.
What took so long to write a book about it, Raymond Moody's?
He was actually, as I recall, even a medical student at that time. It took a long time for him to get about 60 cases of NDEs because, again, it was unknown and people didn't know what the experience was, and he really had to do a lot of questioning and talk to a lot of people to get enough to write a book. I'm a little surprised people didn't recognize this very common pattern even years and years ago. In fact, in retrospect, there's some medical and scientific writings that were clearly NDEs even decades before, but nobody could really put it all together and coin the term near-death experience.
West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Cheyenne, and I'm calling from Idaho.
Hi, Cheyenne.
My question was, when I was in high school, I had a couple of friends that were in, like, automobile accidents, and one of them had the near-death. And one of them actually died multiple times during surgeries and stuff. And when we asked afterwards what they saw, if they saw the light or anything like that, both of them had not seen anything. And I was just wondering about that, where they'd had the death and near death and come back and were both alive. What would cause them not to see anything and someone else to be able to?
Yeah, that's a great question, Cheyenne, because a lot of people think about near-death experiences happening most or essentially all the time that you have a life-threatening event, because it's such a household word, such a powerful experience, and a lot of people say, hey, I nearly died, or I know someone that nearly died, why didn't I have the experience? The answer is only about 10 to 20% of people that have a life-threatening event that nearly die, or actually, you know, like your friends, you know, probably could have clinically had their heart stop or their breathing stop, only about 10 or 20% have a near-death experience. We absolutely don't understand why. There's no way we can predict anything about the individual, their age, when it happened, anything about their prior beliefs to predict why they would or would not have an NDE. So I guess as best you can look at it, you know, those lucky, relatively lucky 10 or 20%, it's a gift to them. It's something that, you know, they can treasure. You know, why the other 80 or 90% of people don't have it, we just don't understand that.
That's a good question, too.
All right, well, thank you.
Okay, Cheyenne, appreciate you being part of the program. Why other people don't experience it? That is a $64,000 question.
You know, it's one of those things, of course, because it's such a small percentage of people have NDEs, it's led to a lot of speculation about why people have had, you know, so many people can come close to death and not remember it. You know, especially given that there doesn't seem to be any correlate with their, you know, any beliefs or whether they thought they'd have an NDE or whether they'd even heard of NDE before. Some of the speculation goes along the lines of, you know, with certain NDEs, as you may have heard other NDEers on this show talk about things, sometimes they are shown a great deal of universal knowledge, how the universe works, how it all fits in, and we've had people just have incredible, vast amounts of wisdom. And when they return to Earth, it seems to be taken away, or they can't remember it all, even though they were clearly aware that they had it. It's possible that a higher percentage of people have actual experiences, but just for whatever reason, they're just not allowed, able, or maybe it's just not the right thing for them to recall that experience. And that's just purely speculation. Really, the bottom line is we don't know, but it is the $64,000 question.
First-time caller line. Hello, you're on the air with us.
Hi, this is Mary Kay from Texas.
Hi, Mary Kay.
As you can probably tell with the accent. But I'm just going to be brief about my first experience, but I want to kind of ask a question about the second one. But on the first one, I was very, very sick, but couldn't do anything about it. There was nothing I could do. I was kind of unconscious and then suddenly realized, you know, what was happening. And he has described what it's like. There's no words to express it. Angels came to visit me when I got there and welcomed me, and the love was like we can't express in words over here. The love was so strong. I asked a lot of questions, and most of it they answered. Every time they answered it in threes, you know, it was not time for me to know. It was not for me to know. It was not for me to know, and that sort of stuff. But they did give me a message of what I was supposed to do back on Earth. They made it pretty clear. And I didn't quite understand it completely, but I knew finally that when the time came, I would know. And sure enough, I did. But they sent me back, and I did all the same thing like he described. I argued about it. You know, didn't want to go, whined, and carried on. And I think one of the most amazing things about it is that you still have your own personality. You know, I argued just the same way I argue down here on Earth. That.
You didn't lose that, huh?
No, I still had my exact same personality, and that part amazed me. Another little piece I had in there that amazed me was that as the first angel, she came out of the water. I landed on the beach, which I'd always asked that heaven just be one giant beach. And sure enough, I landed on the beach, and she comes out of the water, and she was overweight. And in the back of my brain, which seemed to still be my own personal thoughts, I thought, oh, my gosh, I didn't know I'd have to watch my weight over here, too.
Maybe but, you were a cherub.
Huh?
Nothing.
Oh, well, so what I kind of wanted to ask is the second time I had one, which was about 10 years later, I began to realize the exact same thing like before. Uh-oh, I'm going over to the other side, you know. And this time I said, I don't want to go. And all these angels were around me still where I was. I hadn't risen up like before into the tunnel and then into the light. They said it was my choice this time. And they asked, first of all, they asked me why, and I told them the reason why I needed to complete something down here. And they said it was my choice. And so this time I said, okay, I'll go ahead and stay here. And they told me, okay.
Wow.
So that, have you ever heard of that before?
Choice.
Yes.
You have?
Yeah, oh, yes. If you go to my website, you'll find scores and scores of experiences where you're given a choice. Very often, you're sent back against your will, and that's tough. And you tried. I know how hard you tried.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, hey, Mary Kay, thank goodness you came back so we could talk.
Well, I had some little works to do, and I've pretty much completed them now, so.
Yeah, the having a choice is not unusual. And very often there can be in these NDEs a great deal of discussion with the angels or other entities there. And if you may have experienced this. I mean, you may have...
I had big discussions,
There you go. Okay. And, I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, you know that you're home. You know that this is where you belong.
Right.
You know the peace, the love, the beauty, the sense that of connectedness is, and, you know, so apart from what you have on Earth. And it's... You know, it shows a lot of courage. I mean, a lot of people do have choices, and I commend their courage. You know, we all are thinking, why on earth would you leave heaven to come back to Earth?
Yeah, I didn't want to leave heaven then, but the second time I made my choice, kind of reluctantly, but to stay.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is during this dialogue, you realize how important your life's meaning and purpose is. You have things you need to do. I'm just guessing. I mean, I'm not knowing it, but the pattern is so common. It's the things that you had to do on Earth. I would bet it probably involved relationships or some loving action that you would have with those on Earth.
Grandchildren.
Oh, there you go. Uh-huh. And again, I see so many of these accounts, and they're so, you know, I'm not psychic, Mary Kay. It's just the number one by far reason that people choose to come back to Earth is relationships, especially familial relationships. Grandchildren would be right on that. And that's you made the right choice, and it takes a lot of courage to leave those heavenly realms.
Oh yeah, I didn't
come back to Earth. So we're delighted you came back to fulfill your earthly purpose here.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're up. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to throw kind of a little monkey wrench in this for a second. What I was wondering about is, you know, people are always trying to validate this, that this is a real experience, and always wondering about possibly is there another life over there on the other side. I was wondering to ask the doctor, I think there's a way that you could prove that, is if you've ever had a chance to talk to somebody that has never been raised with any religious beliefs whatsoever, doesn't have a belief system like that at all, but then does have an NDE and comes back and describes what the Bible and everybody thinks heaven is. Have you ever run into that?
Oh, sure. We have people that are, you know, maybe that, I mean, it's hard to say that they've lived their whole life and not had any belief systems. Well, yeah, actually, probably the best analogy for that are people that have NDEs very, very young at life, like, you know, age 2, age 3, where they're really not to the point where they've developed belief systems. And certainly even in these particular individuals, obviously there's no way they could step into church or they could really understand. I mean, they wouldn't even really hardly have the language skills at the very, very young age like that. And yet their NDEs, even at this extreme young age, are remarkably similar or identical to those that are adults. You know, you raised a really, really good point there. I don't think anyone's ever really thought about that or developed that line of evidence about the reality of NDEs, but I think that's absolutely true. And you're right. If you find NDEers that don't have beliefs, were raised in an atheist home and are atheists themselves, you know, certainly they can have NDEs that are just like anybody else's NDEs. Good point.
What's the most NDEs one person has had?
Oh, wow. I had one dramatic account from somebody who had some variation of sleep apnea, and that's just a technical word for meaning that they basically stop breathing while they're asleep. That's a rare condition, but they had it like dozens of times. They wouldn't really go into detail.
Dozens?
Yeah, because they had clinically stopped breathing. That's part of the clinical condition.
Gee, stay with us. We'll come back with final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Back to the phones we go, west of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there. Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is John from Bonnie Lake, Washington. And in 1968, a friend of mine and myself were on my motorcycle in Plantation, Florida. And about 6 blocks away from my house, on the way to school, as a young man, we were broadsided by a car going 40 miles an hour, and we were only going about 5 miles an hour. And I flew through the air about 30 feet and wound up in the hospital, both of us did. Compound fracture, top of my left foot completely gone down to the bone. And I was in a coma for 3 days. Now, my friend, he had a broken leg, but I was the worst. But anyways, they were going to cut my leg off, and because of prayer, the poisons that were in the leg started to recede, and the doctors went ahead and reconstructed the reconstructive surgery, and everything turned out to where I could save my leg with a 75% lifelong disability, which I have now. Now, the most important part about this is that Phil, my friend, and I, being young friends, we went, boarded together when we left home. And one night, we decided that we were raised in the Church of the Nazarene.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't living right, and we knew it. And I went to a revival meeting expecting something to happen. I just had an anticipation, but nothing happened. And we came home that night, and as we were getting ready to go to bed, laying down actually, I was praying, and my friend didn't know it. And all of a sudden, this feeling came upon me, George, that is beyond, I cannot, words do not describe. And after the third time me questioning my friend, I said, Phil, now I know you feel something, because I was asking God to let him feel it too. He raised his hands up in the air, and for 3 hours he cried. And our bodies glowed. I'm telling you God's honest truth. Our bodies glowed white. We felt like, I knew that if this continued on, that I would have to leave my body because I couldn't stay in my flesh and contain this.
Did you think you were having this near-death experience?
Absolutely, but it was a spiritual, it was revealing to me what it was going to be like when Jesus said he was going to, in the twinkling of an eye, change us from mortal to immortal.
Ever get cases like that, Jeffrey?
Yeah, that's a spiritual experience, but not a near-death experience. If it's a NDE, that has to occur at the time of the life-threatening
right.
event. I mean, these are still very meaningful and powerful experiences. They're just not NDEs.
I didn't think so. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
Hey. I wanted to just, I'm going to try to move through this quickly. I'm starting to feel like I'm not the Lone Ranger with a near-death experience anymore.
No.
Not at
all.
Oh,
my God. Well, mine totally was phenomenal and everything. One thing I wanted to ask you, if this is common, I did see a... kind of like if you were to fast forward a movie, I saw future events. I also do not consider myself at the time of the NDE to be a religious person, but what I thought was way, it has changed my life. This is 20 years ago. I get goosebumps. Is how intimate and personal the relationship with God was. I thought there was probably a God that he was out there somewhere. This was, I was talking to God. I was arguing with God. I was crying. I did not want to go back. I said, I don't want to leave you.
You didn't want to go back?
I didn't want to go back to earth. No, I didn't want to leave him. I had never known such love. All the hunger that you hunger for love in your life is I mean, you know, nothing compares.
What had you left behind?
I had two small children.
Oh my God!
Yeah. And I am so I'm embarrassed to say that that wasn't enough. I wanted to be with God.
Oh, Nancy, you should not be embarrassed. The great, great, great majority of people that have NDEs, even if it happens at childbirth, even as people are actually giving children, if they have an NDE, just like you, they know their home, they feel that profound love, and they don't want to return to Earth. Your response was absolutely normal, natural, and expected under the circumstances because, Nancy, as you know, the NDE is that profound a message, profound an experience.
It has been so profound. I still cry. The thing is that I said, I do not want to leave you, and he said, but I am with you there. You're the one that closes the door, and I had to think about how I closed the door on this side. I guess ignorance, not understanding, maybe not totally believing. I don't know what closes that door between man and God. That was the profound million-dollar question for me, is why? How is it so hard to carry that relationship back here with you, you know, and to keep that the cognizance of that. That God feeling. Why is it so hard to achieve it here, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing. But But it was I was guilt ridden that I had not wanted to come back, and life has not been easy. And he said, when it's not easy, I'll be there. But the thing is, we still make our mistakes. Oh, I was going to say, also, I knew who I was. It's like we have amnesia down here. We don't know who we really are.
Yeah.
Have you heard that?
Oh, all the time. I mean, we are real being. That's why we're not home here. That's exactly what I've been saying all night, Nancy, and you're saying now. You know, as you know from your experience, your real home, who you really are, which is far, far more than we are on Earth, you have some awareness of when you're having an NDE.
East of the Rockies, your turn. Hi.
Yes, hi. This is Alec from Tampa.
Hi, Alec.
When I was, I'm a little bit nervous. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I can still remember this to the date. I was swimming near a bunch of boathouses. Me and a friend of mine were. And I happened to knock myself out on a piling. All I remember was taking water in, waking up on the bottom of the lake bed, and when I opened my eyes, the water was murky. When I opened my eyes, I could see everything within half a mile in all directions. I heard a voice that told me, "Do not breathe in the water." And I said, "Why?" And it told me that it was not my time to go yet. And also, about 10, 15 years later, I was under the water for 6.5 minutes. I could actually hear my friend calling the Coast Guard on the abandoned boat. When I came up, I was able to see the way through the pilings to get up to the surface.
Uh-huh.
And about 10, 15 years later, I was driving a friend of mine up to Nashville, or up from Nashville up to Kentucky. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, out of nowhere, I hear this other voice, that same voice that said, downshift into second, floor it, and swerve hard right. Do not ask any questions or you're dead. As soon as I did that, everything seemed to stop. I looked to my left, and there is a gas tanker,
cool,
fully loaded.
Jeez.
Barreling right at you.
4 feet from my door.
Now, Jeffrey, what are these? Because these aren't near-death experiences, are they? Or?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, the first one, I think, where you got knocked out, you could see a half mile in all direction. It's very typical that vision and hearing can become far more accurate than exist during our earthly life, and that may be what's going on. Then to get into that last experience, you know, where you had that sense of downshifting, while that's not a near-death experience because you aren't physically compromised or unconscious.
So that's some kind of intuitive thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it could be psychic, or it could be some kind of, contact by you know, some kind of protective entity or power that is there. It's a little hard to say. While it's not an NDE, obviously that not only was a dramatic experience, Alec, it was obviously life-saving.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is George from Fostoria, Ohio.
Hey, George. Go ahead, sir.
In 1984, I had an NDE, and I went through the tunnel, went to the light, wanted to get in. They told me I couldn't. I had to go back and wish I was back. But this light, this woman that was on sometime after 2 o'clock here in the east, was talking about how much love came from this light. Well, I experienced the same thing. This was in 84. Now, let's jump back to 1967. I was in the military. I'd just come home from Vietnam. And I was on guard duty out in the desert in the Diablo Hill Canyon Range. Myself and 3 other soldiers were on guard duty. We noticed something in the sky. I ended up getting abducted. While I was on this craft, I don't know how I got on it or how I got back to the ground. But I was examined by 3 small gray aliens, and there was another gray alien there. I'm 5'8", and he was at least my size or maybe bigger. I couldn't tell because I was laying down. after the examination was through, they took me fully dressed again to a room with a light being inside this room. The only difference in this experience and the NDE experience was, in this experience, I was wide awake in my body, fully aware of what was going on, and was having a conversation with this light being that emanated the same rays of love that I got at the end of the tunnel. And this light told me that something in the near future wonderful was going to happen for the whole world. Whatever the near future is to them, I don't know what their lifespan is. But I just found it amazing that I would run into a spiritual being on a UFO, if you want to call it that, and the same thing at the end of the tunnel, and anybody that thinks that the two are connected should think again.
Not an actual NDE, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think the first one, you know, I'm not sure of the circumstances where you went through the tunnel and saw the light and were sent back. You know, that could be if you were, you know, having severe degree of physical compromise. But that, you know, alien abductions are that's, of course, not an NDE, but still, thanks for sharing.
Do you have other people talk about abductions?
I think that's less than 5 out of the 800 or so I've heard.
Oh, so minimal.
Yeah, almost none, yeah.
West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Eddie, San Diego. How you doing, Doc?
Hi.
George, talked to you a long time ago. We're Gemini brothers. I want to say congratulations on your 5 years because I'll probably never get in again. I want to wish Art the best.
All right, thanks.
If any brother needs to be loved, it's that man there. I'm a little nervous, like the doctor was saying earlier. Really, I've only told a couple of people about this. Let me catch my breath. 2001, had quadruple bypass surgery. Didn't go as well as I guess they're supposed to. Now, I guess it happens sometimes. They punctured a lung in the middle of the surgery. So when I went into the ICU, there was complications, but, you know, I remember people coming and looking at me, and then it just went black. And then the next thing I know, I'm hanging out with the ICU nurse doing rounds with her. Now, I really couldn't see her face, but what I saw was different colors from her emotions. She would go from her patient to patient. And if the patient was doing good, the aura would be kind of blue. If they're doing bad, you know, not real good, it would be kind of black. And then when she would get to me, I felt this overwhelming love. And then it seemed like an eternity. I mean, it just seemed like, and if I had to describe it in a word, it was like the ultimate celebration of consciousness.
Uh-huh.
It was just warm, like tropical, but you know, I didn't see no tunnels. I just kind of cruised. Now, what's kind of strange to this part of the story is I work in the drug and alcohol field, and I have for the last 18 years. And, you know, so I haven't had a drink or drug in quite a few days in a row. And, you know, I was cruising around with this nurse, and like I said, it seemed like forever. And then all of a sudden all these bells and whistles went off, and there was all this commotion going on in the ICU. And then all of a sudden I heard a voice, "Hey, Eddie, what are you doing?" And then the next thing I can remember is they're pulling the tube out of my mouth, and the nurse looking at me, and she says, "You're going to be okay, Mr. Walton." And I looked at her, I said, "How are you doing?" And she goes, "Excuse me?" I go, I know you lost a patient last night. How are you doing?" And the phrase, the poco hair, I'm saying, she turned a whiter shade of pale and kind of ran out of the room. And then no one really said, you know, when I went up to the, you know, to the cardiac ward, you know, I kind of wanted to talk with my surgeon, you know, because I was kind of a little bit disappointed about the lung being punctured, because when I went in there, I had two good lungs.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, you're not really going to complain when they save your life. I mean, I was 46 years old, you know, and I'm 52 now. You know, for many, many, many days in a row, I've wondered, was that an outer body experience or near-death experience? And then I listened to the doctor's take the first hour of the show. And, you know, I've been listening to this program, put it this way. I listened to Art Bell in 1969 when he had a radio station called KUDE and he played rock and roll. I used to wait for him to come on to play Inagata Navita, okay? And then I started with Coast to Coast in 1990. So there's probably a million people out there that argue with me, but I've been listening to Art and you probably longest of anybody on the planet. You know, but I don't call that often because I like to listen because that's what I do for a living.
Let's get your take because we only have a minute left here. Eddie, what's your take on this, Jeffrey?
It's hard to say. Eddie, your heart stopped at the time you were having this out-of-body experience?
No, it did not, I'm sure.
Okay. Then you probably just had an out-of-body experience in the ICU, and that'd be hard to call an NDE, because especially in the ICU, you get a lot of medication that can affect the brain. But that out-of-body experience, especially if you're following the nurse, and what you're seeing is real, is just part of the spectrum of NDE-like experiences. It can be dramatic, and it can be real.
I'll tell you one thing, Jeffrey. Lots of people share similar experiences, don't they?
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm interested. NDE is a spectrum of experiences, just like Eddie described. Sometimes it's a little hard to know where to draw the line, and sometimes you don't know, but... You know, I think the spectrum or the similarity of other experiences just suggests the reality of NDE. I mean, that's dramatic to, you know, be able to follow a nurse with your consciousness and see what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And understand what she's thinking.
Amazing. Jeffrey, thanks for being on the program. Appreciate it.
It has been a sincere pleasure, George.
And so we wrap up Sunday night into Monday morning for Kyrus Coburn, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you Monday night. Until then, be safe, everybody.